Can you? Right. Good. Okay, fine. All right. That's enough. I think we have enough specimens now.
The sound of a man finding what he was set on this earth to do.
You think this is a new species?
Oh, yeah. And not a little one either. Look at
collect ants.
I don't know how we could have missed this before.
Great ants.
It's a big ant.
Yeah.
Great. All right.
That's entomology.
Yeah.
That's evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson in the Dominican Republic finding one of his beloved ant species. He's never lost that sense of excitement about the world around us in his more than 80 years as just one of the organisms he's studied. A six-decade career, 27 books, all probing the connection between biology and the social behavior of animals, especially ants, but also humans. It was ants that gave him the first insight that human behavior, social morality, even that elusive concept called human nature, has a biological basis. It has gotten him into some controversy more than once, being accused of somehow justifying human intolerance as part of our biological evolution. Well, Professor E.O. Wilson's new book, The Social Conquest of Earth, comes back to this subject with a lifetime of wisdom and learning. His knowledge of why humans are social creatures and exhibit traits like altruism all begins, he says, with the ants and the mystery of how ants manage to survive in the tops of trees.
That's one of the adaptations that made ants dominant organisms in the world. And, you know, in most habitats of the world, they make up something like a third of the entire animal biomass. For example, in the Amazon, and this is probably typical of other environments, many other environments around the world, ants alone outweigh all of the land vertebrates, mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians, 4-1. So they really are dominant animals, and part of the reason for that is just what you said. They've found out ways through social organization to penetrate all kinds of environments and control them. In the rainforest canopy, but elsewhere in a few other habitats, the ants there are able to, they have been able to leave the earth, their natural home and environment, and go up in the trees, partly by living in hollow stems of twigs and trees, branches up there, and also epiphytes, you know, the orchids and other things. But more than that, having found substitute earth up there, they live up there and dominate the canopy by living in symbiosis, maintaining herds of sap-sucking insects, like scale insects.
They have livestock. Sap-sucking insects are livestock for ants, and it's a way for them to be vegetarians, even though they're acting like predators. How does that work?
They violate the iron rule of hymenopteron, that is, you know, these ant biology, which is that they are not vegetarians. They can't handle plant material. They are separated by at least one link from this endless food resource. However, sap-sucking insects, scale insects, mealy bugs, creatures like that, familiar to most, are vegetation feeders. They take the sap from the living tissue of the trees, and the ants collect their excrement, which is sugary, has a certain quantity of sugar in it, and some amino acids. And in exchange for that excrement that the sapsuckers pass out to them, they provide protection. They build shelters for the maintenance of their dairy herds, and also they protect them from predators. So as a result, both build up enormous populations.
Not an appetizing thought for our conversation, but nevertheless an important evolutionary feature for this species, all based on altruism, doing a favor for some mealybugs.
They're doing it across species in this case, although it's more like just a straight exchange.
Sure.
However, within the colony, and this brings us within reach, shall we say, of the human story, they are successful because the members of the colony do sacrifice themselves on behalf of the colony. Most ant workers, they're all female, incidentally, give up reproduction altogether. Some of them don't even have reproductive organs. And thus they surrender their ability to have direct and offspring of their own in the service of the colony.
You describe that these traits are very deep in the various species that you've studied them in, including animal species, including human species. How do we understand, or do we even come close to understanding, the mechanism whereby these behaviors and traits get transmitted, get spread around?
That's part of the foundation of the book, The Social Conquest of Earth. The question is, how did they do it? I mean, why was it possible for a very small number of species? I've been able to find only about 24 evolutionary lines in the history of life that have pulled off what the social insects have pulled off and what humans have pulled off independently. It's a rare phenomenon, and yet those who achieved it became controlling elements in the environment overall. So that brings us then to the question of why it hasn't been achieved more often. If it brings enormous success, you know, like inventing Facebook.
Why? There you go. Another Harvard story up there.
Yeah, right? Why haven't, has it occurred more and more often? Well, it does have to do with that phenomenon of altruism, which baffled Darwin, incidentally. He kind of figured it out.
In a way, it's the ability of animals to move beyond being solitary creatures that creates family units and then whole communities that really changes the game.
It's the key step, and it's reached only by a very small number of evolving lines of the animals. Very few get up to the point where they have a nest that they're defending from which they go out foraging and bring back food to the growing offspring unto maturity. And that has occurred in a small percentage of animal species in evolution, and of those, only a very few have taken the next step over, which is for the young to stay with the adults and then participate altruistically to some degree with maintaining the whole group.
Do you think altruism explains why humans have an extraordinary amount of long-term memory? We hold on to memories and memories
well,
of community.
Well, we know the answer to that. That really probably began about the time of the Habilines. Homo habilis, one of our direct precursors, starting about 3 million years ago. That's when the brain began its phenomenal growth, up from the level of about the chimpanzee, 400 to 500 cubic centimeters, to the extraordinary weight and complexity it is today. That was achieved in only about 2 million years, or a little more. And that has to do with the coming together of a group that reads intention of others, that has to have social intelligence in order to achieve cooperation. And that is what gives a particular group operating altruistically and in coordination that gives superiority over other groups. That provides group selection, the process of group selection.
And expands
and that
the brain.
Group selection involving social intelligence is what drove the human species to line up to what we are today.
Looking back on your long career, this attempt to use biology as an explanation of behavior has landed you in controversy more than a few times. How much of your thoughts now is an attempt to correct the record or get it right or somehow make it easier for humans to have a conversation about biology and behavior?
In 1975, when I made human social behavior part of the subject of this new discipline of sociobiology, then I ran into a lot of trouble because it was standard thought in those days, social scientists and on the political left, that the brain is a blank slate and that humans have no instincts. They have no human nature. That got me in deep trouble. But basically, it turned out to be correct. We have the evidence it was correct even then. I helped correct it in a book called On Human Nature in 1978. That helped spawn the subject of evolutionary psychology. And that and a lot of other work since then, I think, cleared away that original controversy and made it clear that there is such a thing as human nature. What I've done in this new book is to try to look at the entire panorama of social evolution, place human beings in it, and with research done by many people over the last 10, 20 years, find out what the critical step was and when it happened.
All right. for more than 40 years, a professor at Harvard University, E.O. Wilson, biologist and author of The Social Conquest of Earth. Thanks as always.
Thank you, sir.
We'll get you back here for the next one, right?
Yes,
oh,
please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.